afternoon. Oops. There we go. All of a sudden we had sound and then we didn't have sound. So good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And our guest is Dr. Sid.
Dr. Fraser Crane.
Yeah, it is kind of like that, isn't it?
Fasten your seatbelts.
Told Bob, I go, you get to play all sorts of fun music. Bill gets to goof off. Okay, Aaron gets to goof off. It's going to be great. And you know, it was a pure accident that we're having Dr. Sid on the radio. I wound up chatting with him on the phone this week. And now today we find out that the guy in Las Vegas might have had mental illness.
Get out of here.
No.
No.
This just in. Like, are you kidding me? No pressure. Pull that just a little bit closer because it doesn't pick up very well.
There you go.
There we go. Now I can hear you in my ears.
Yeah, I heard that on the news last night.
Bill went nuts.
I wanted to throw a shoe through the TV. It's like, we've waited a week.
It's like, are you kidding me?
And they didn't get the answers they wanted, so he's mentally ill now.
Like a week ago, we didn't know that.
Like, we didn't know that somebody that goes out and kills a bunch of people and then kills himself isn't mentally ill. We're too stupid to figure that out. They got to tell us.
They have to have that on the news. Oh, and that's all they're talking about today, apparently. Yeah, it was on my news feed last night, I thought. Oh, tomorrow's going to be tons of fun, and that wasn't even what we were going to talk about.
What did they diagnose him with? I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Mental illness.
They didn't say what kind?
No.
Wow.
No,
they're just you know,
he had undiagnosed mental disorders for a long time.
Yeah. I can tell you right now what I think it was. Nonspecific frontal lobe damage. It's the, like I was telling you the other day on the phone, the breaks in your brain that say stop when you feel like killing somebody or hitting somebody, the thing that goes, wait a minute, don't do that, gets smacked, dinged, or knocked out of action for some reason.
Really?
And yeah.
That's an actual thing?
Impulses bubble. Heck yeah. Hmm? Heck yeah. Hmm. Frontal lobe damage takes the brakes off of your brain, knocks your impulse control down, and can, in a variety of ways, be really... really big problem. And that's not to say, you know, there might have been something going on like schizophrenia, personality disorder, you know, narcissistic.
Can you tell any of this if the person's dead?
Do
you have to be able to talk to them? Or can you, like, spy inside their head and see it? Is it a visual thing?
You could probably do a brain assay postmortem to see if there's damage to the frontal lobe.
Huh.
The reason I bring that up, the whole CTE thing in the NFL, chronic traumatic encephalitis. That's a manifestation of that.
Yeah, that's a real thing.
When they all become criminals and stuff
same
like that,
thing,
even
or
though
kill
some
themselves.
Of them are criminals.
Yeah, people that seem to be, you know, stars and well balanced guys and everything, and next thing you know, they're suicidal, and that's due to traumatic brain injury to the frontal lobe. So,
Well, there you go.
Okay.
So the next time you feel like I should
have
had a
V8.
I should have had a
don't
V8. Stop doing that.
Yeah. No, hit yourself in the nose instead.
Yeah, don't do that.
Preferably with an upward direction, right? So let's see. I culled some things out of your resume. Kind of a weird way to do it, to try to figure out. I'm like, I don't know much about him, but I've got to post some stuff. So looks like you were born in Baton Rouge.
Yes, ma'am.
How exciting! I was like, you didn't have an accent. What's up with that?
I went to LSU.
Oh, there you go.
And I ate crawfish.
Married, has six children.
And catfish, a lot of catfish.
Six that we know of.
Six children. And you have an office that's in Reading, and if anybody needs to go there, the address is posted online.
Oh, no.
Along with the phone number. Please call ahead. And you've been in private practice since 1981. So,
wow, yeah. So, holy cow, so I'm over 40 now.
You know, from a regular person perspective, that's a lot of crazy people. A lot.
Evaluations alone over 25,000.
Stop it.
No, seriously, and that's not counting private patients. So
that's evaluate because without flipping to it, it's what do you do for the state?
I do disability evals for the state. That is people that may have had a motorcycle accident with a coma, traumatic brain injury, a stroke, people that may have schizophrenia and they're taking their meds and still can't function. So
I saw one of them up front earlier, actually.
Yeah.
Did tattoos all over his face. What causes you to do that?
A lot of guys get
colorful tattoos like on your face, literally on your cheeks and your nose and stuff.
A lot of guys have seen parolees coming out of prison or having a lot of facial stuff.
Really?
That signifies different things. So
his was sort of circusy. It was colorful, very colorful, kind of in a circus sort of motif.
Like the movie It?
Yeah, the there you go. That could have been it.
Creepy.
He was the creepy clown without the shoes. So
a lot of evals, quite a few privates as well. Working with the district attorney's office in a couple of counties, doing assessment for them. A lot of pain evals. For
a lot of what?
Pain, chronic pain evaluations. Evals. Yeah, for intravertebral disc surgeries,
why would you have to have a psychiatric evaluation for pain?
To make sure you know what you're getting into. You know, a lot of people have been on narcotic pain medication a really long time, and they're not thinking clearly. So we're trying to make sure they're aware of risk and complications of surgeries, just to make sure they know what they're getting into. And then classic case I had of a guy that was a bull rider with a back injury and was looking at stem surgery.
I'm sure that hardly ever happens.
Yeah, and he's looking at stem surgery, which knocks the pain down without correcting the problem, and would like to do it a little part-time maybe still. And it's like, no. I don't think our surgeon's going to be okay with that.
Yeah, it's a big NO from your, from all fronts.
So a really wide range of people, a lot of kids with severe ADHD and autism.
I saw you had a huge
number of those.
Period of time where you worked with youth.
Yeah, I still do. I still work. I do a lot of evals for the Department of Social Services for disability for severe ADHD and autism. And there's some cases that can be dramatically improved with proper medication if needed. And, you know, a quick summary is a lot of parents are nervous about giving a child a medication. And if it comes down to a medication preventing a kid from bolting out in front of a car and getting killed, I say do the medication. So my take on that,
given the choices,
the take on that for me, I taught pharmacology too. The take on the medication thing is, number one, if it's a serious risk to the child of injury or serious harm or death, do it. And the other one is when the teacher starts saying, look, this little guy is falling further and further behind, disruption, getting kicked out of school, has to go to another school or whatever, then you have really loud and clear behavior observations saying, look, we don't want to medicate anybody when they're a kid, but, you know, there are times when you need to consider that.
Do you think kids today, you know, you hear over-medicated, you know, everybody wants to medicate their kid. Maybe they don't, but a lot of doctors say, hey, he just needs a little Ritalin to settle him down a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, I don't think I knew anybody that was medicated.
Mom.
And today it seems like a lot of kids are medicated. What's the answer there?
I think for sure I was a ADHD kid. I know.
No.
I was hyperactive. You know, I was into sports. I lost sweaters. I lost basketballs. I lost footballs. I was late getting home, so I know I had the hyperactive thing going on, and I corralled it enough to get through school and kind of outgrew it by the time I was about 18, which a lot of kids do. By the time they get mid to later teens, they outgrow
kind of figure
it.
Out how to
yeah. –
do they literally outgrow it, or do they learn
well, no, the
how
frontal
to –
lobe, the frontal lobe matures.
Oh.
If you do a PET scan of the brain – an ADHD brain, you'll see it's not dark, but a lot darker color. So there's less metabolic activity there. So with maturity and, with maturity, basically, it's like the sprinklers on that part of their brain come on and it starts working. So the problem is we don't want them to be so freaking far behind or involved in juvenile justice that their path in life is already set up.
Yeah, before it kicks on.
Before it even gets going.
Yeah.
So, I am absolutely not for medicating when not necessary. But there are times, if you look at the statistics, particularly with Adderall, I did a pharmacology talk, and they did a long-term graph of the kid's age and who was intervened with ADHD med and who was not. And, oh, my God, the injury rate is three times as high. The incarceration rate's through the roof.
No kidding.
People in prison, yeah. Because here's what happens. The people with ADHD, one of two things happens. They're impulsive, hyperactive. They get in trouble in school. They end up in the wrong
group. Make bad choices.
Yeah, then
right?
They go to YA. Then they end up in prison. Or here's a fascinating thing that happens. They know they're hyper. They know they're overactive. They want to mellow out, so they take meth. And they get busted for meth, which, believe it or not, is in the right general category of medication to control it.
Because it speeds them up to slow them down?
Exactly. Yeah, the meth on an ADHD brain will slow it down and calm it down.
Wow. So yeah, I think taking, a meth is just going to speed them up more.
No, that for every normal brain it does.
Yeah.
You know, if we were to take meth, except for you, Aaron, if any of us took meth, it would probably speed us up.
Almost Aaron, everything goes. Yeah, yeah, like, I did.
But it's a real irony that these people, and then they get busted for that, then they go to prison, then they get UA, urine screens for it, and they can't do it. So it's kind of a paradox.
Interesting.
There.
Well, as we're walking around in the city streets these days, you know, I don't care what city you live in, I think we're learning a lot more about mental illness than we ever really wanted to know.
Oh,
so seemed like it would be a good time to have you come in and talk to us about this. So we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Sid. I'm sure we will go all sorts of places because we have no plan.
Yeah.
How's
and
that
I, and
for
I
full
have a
disclosure?
Million questions.
Full disclosure. Yeah. There's no plan.
Because I have this friend who, well, we'll get into that later.
Yeah, I had this dream the other night. It was so cool.
No,
like
no.
All these
this friend.
Trains.
I had a friend who had a dream.
A special friend.
My
oh,
really
my God. Life here at We the People is a lot more fun than usual. WeThePeopleRadio.us. Join us online.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
I knew Bob was going to have fun with the music today. What a great topic, right? So during the break, we were talking about Obamacare, talk about things that make people crazy.
Yes.
Okay, so your premium this year without it. Oh, yeah, you brought it. I forgot
I'm
about
sorry.
That.
And it was written in such a kind way.
With the form letter?
Yeah, it's really a
dear
taxpayer. It's actually from Anthem, calling to let you know your plan will no longer be available. We have found you a comparable plan. Your estimated
comparable.
Yeah, your estimated payment will be $3,360.
Oh, is that all? $3,000?
But with your subsidy, it should only be $1,941.
Wow.
This is for me, my healthy wife, and I'm healthy too, I think, and my 7-year-old son who's very healthy. This is for a healthy family of three, $1,941 with a subsidy of $1,400. So I'm going, where do we go here?
And we all know the subsidy isn't really a subsidy.
Well, it came back, yeah.
I mean, yeah, and then all of a sudden if they decide that, you know, something changed or whatever, by the way, you get to pay it back.
Yeah.
Surprise!
Yeah, you can make a certain amount of money, but if you go over that apparently one iota, that's what happened with me. You know, that's how we met. It's like, wait a minute. Oh, by the way, we thought you qualified, but you don't. So give us back $18,900.
Yeah, they'll take a check or money order.
Sure, yeah, I'll just
take payments $100 a month with interest, and you pay for it. Oh wait,
and make your quarterly.
Your
great doesn't matter if you're $1 over the threshold; they want the whole $18,000 back.
I'm afraid so. Nice. And then the weird part is, once you pay that, then that's going to change your write-offs for that year. So whatever you can write out for your medical insurance will drop you down to what you can be taxed at. So it's just a giant train wreck, in my opinion.
That's a nice way of putting it.
And we've heard that from
tons of people.
A lot of people that go to do their taxes and at the end of the year, and then all of a sudden they find out that
the subsidy
is killing them.
Yeah, the highest one I've heard was $8,000, so you're going to beat by, you know, 10-9.
Yeah,
you're
way over that.
You are the
high
achiever.
It's quite an incentive to go out and be successful. I mean,
right.
You know,
when somebody calls to be a new patient,
yeah,
I'm really feeling bad. I'm so solid. Oh, my God, Doc, I got to get some help. I'm sorry, if I see you, I will have to pay $18,000.
I can't do it.
It's just unbelievable.
You'll have to deal with your own mental illness today.
Quota.
But I don't think that way. I honestly got it.
No,
can't.
If somebody calls, you know, or you get an eval, I like to work except on the weekend. It's not a put down to you guys, but I don't have to work in the weekend. I'm very happy you could find a job talking to
me. Because you have a soccer problem.
This really isn't work.
He's got a soccer problem. That's
not an obsession.
Just, can, you know, Except when I texted in the address for the place today, he reads me a soccer text. I'm like,
no, it's
that,
like,
wasn't,
what a great,
that wasn't me.
It's like, what a great team. I said, I think I got your text. I opened it up. I said, what a great team victory against an undefeated team. We played our little hearts out. We have a lot of kids with attention problems, but we really hung in there. And I thought,
and
that's,
I'm like,
not Aaron.
I'm like, no, it was the address for the studio. Different text. So one of the things I meant to ask you about was the clinical hypnosis part. You started, it looks like the beginning of a lot of your career stuff was in the
Time ago when I was at Emory Pain Control Center doing my my internship back there near Georgia. I think it was in Decatur. But we had a pain clinic, and they were, Dr. Brenna, this little, I think he was from Vienna, little Viennese guy.
Brenna from Vienna. That
buck
makes sense.
Teeth, bald, glasses. He's like, Sid, you must learn hypnosis. We want to try hypnosis. I want you to go. I pay for you to go to learn hypnosis. So I went to this conference, and it's pretty cool what you can do with that. So then we came back, and we had a really dramatic case of an intractable migraine headache lady that the meds wouldn't work on, and we did hypnosis, and bingo bango, it might have receded anyway, but it receded
like at the exact same
minutes.
Time.
Yeah, so it's like, well, that can really work in certain cases. And I got trained with Bill Kroger, who did a first C-section under hypnosis on somebody. So,
like, no pain meds, did a C-section?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's done some pretty amazing stuff with that. So,
I don't know a lot about C-section, but I know they saw you open and take a baby out.
Yeah. Like. But there's some. Everything has its limits, and clinical hypnosis has a lot of really cool applications for, especially for pain management, for confidence, concentration. You don't want to go to La La Land and relax if there's something you need to be solving. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like you use hypnosis a lot to relax and get calm and focus, but you don't just drift in a blissful state of relaxation when you have to pay your mortgage. I mean, there's problem solving involved too, so
sure.
It has
right.
its place.
Does it work
know?
For stuff? I mean, they always are having these. You hear them on the radio, and, mm-hmm. and yeah, I guess you see them on TV sometimes.
Oh, the
quit smoking,
lose
yeah.
weight.
Yeah.
yeah,
does it work for that?
It does. It does work. I'd say,
or
for
should I
probably,
say, could it work for that? Probably
absolutely.
Isn't everybody.
Probably, I would say at least a third of the people it'll work for, and they'll do usually some type of that's a little bit different. The big group things. Like,
oh, is that what they
hypnosis.
Do?
That's a little different than medical/clinical hypnosis.
Huh. That yeah. worked really well
that
for Bill
for
at one
mm-hmm.
point.
Yeah, cool. I was the village people. I was.
He did.
Quite,
he did the village people YMCA dance
mm-hmm. yeah.
in front of a lot of strangers.
Which is really weird because I don't typically like to do things in front of crowds. You have mm-hmm. no inhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you pretty much – I shouldn't say that because one thing that I think lets people go to that state is they tell you they're not going to have you do something or you wouldn't do something
you would ordinarily do under
that
some
you wouldn't ordinarily
right.
do.
Exactly, and that's absolutely
but
right.
Trust me, I wouldn't ordinarily jump up
but
in front
what,
of a bunch
what
of people
happened
and do
was
the YMCA.
You, yeah, you got in your brain, it's perfectly okay, and it's not only okay, it's expected to do this, and that's what
right.
we call
it. He was super excited about
yeah.
it. You could see, like, they started to play the music,
yeah.
and all of them were like, oh! It's us. Like, they yeah. were super excited. And
yeah,
it was
bizarre.
It was at the fair. And so we were in the equipment business,
mm-hmm.
and the tractor booth was right next to the little Pepsi stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so this lady was the hypnotist all week.
Mm-hmm.
So every time Bill walked over there, he was anywhere near, and she would start talking, all of a sudden, oh, there goes Bill.
I did. I sat down. I was by myself, and she was going on stage, so I sat in the back, and I sat next to a guy, and I was just going to sit there because I could see my booth from where I was sitting, and if somebody came over, I could run over there. So she started talking, and the next thing I know, I open my eyes, and my head, I was sleeping on this guy's shoulder, and
wow.
he was kind of starting to kind of set me up a little bit, and
he's like, buddy, you're leaning on me.
What's the problem, man? I'm just taking a little nap.
Was it a post-hypnotic suggestion?
You'll
get something where every time you hear a bell, you'll fall asleep or something.
No,
like
well,
that.
Every time he heard her voice, it was like whatever she was talking about,
mm-hmm.
he had been, we didn't know he had sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had been really tired.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden that all happened at the same time. And we had a guy come into the store. I was working in the store. I only went down there in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy comes in. He goes, I saw Bill at the fair. I go, oh, yeah. You know, did you go by the booth? He goes, yeah. He goes, He was kind of like Mr. Rogers. He was a little weird. Like, and I go, what are you talking about? He goes, well, he was sitting in a lawn chair with sunglasses on, and he said, hi.
Oh, whoa.
Well, one of the post-hypnotic suggestions they give you is you're going to feel, when you wake up, you're going to feel better than you ever did. You're going to be relaxed. You're going to enjoy the fair. You're going to blah, 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 blah. But one of them was you're going to be relaxed.
Like, feel rested.
Feel rested. And I guess I did. You don't realize it, but
yeah,
he was freaking people out.
Yeah,
I remember. I just brought back something for me. I remember training for my pilot's license, my VFR license. I was really nervous about flying in heights at that point in my life, and I used a hypnotic suggestion. When you're piloting a plane, your mind is perfectly calm, crystal clear, and totally aware. And that's what clicked the second I got into the plane. And it's like no panic, no nothing, calm, clear, and aware. You're not like sleepy headed. You're looking, see what's going on, and that served me really, really well for quite a while, including a situation in which I'm coming back on my first cross country flight, playing it safe, flying over I-5 North at 3,000 feet. You can't get any more safe than that.
Yeah, you're not going to get lost up there.
Whatever happens, and you can land on the freeway. Yeah.
And you can land on the freeway, right?
Harry, bad luck. Two friggin' army guys in a helicopter. Freaking dead on, looking straight down, and I dove right to get out of the way. But then I realized this could be dangerous.
This place is too crowded for me.
There were army people with their stuff. I mean, they have all their detection stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like
doing arminess, and they don't care what you're doing.
Yeah, there's all this space in the freaking sky. What the heck? What are the odds of me running into an Army helicopter? But anyway.
And so then you didn't fly anymore?
No, I did. I flew a little bit more. And then the question arose, where do I have to fly in a single-engine airplane? That, I'm full with my practice. So what do I do? Do I fly to Santa Rosa one day a week and back, or do I just work full-time here? So I've been very blessed to have, good business here.
Right.
So I kind of came up. And plus trying to find what is the hospital in Bernie? Is it Mayor's, is it?
Yes, Mayor's Memorial.
Mayor's Hospital, yes. I get a gig there. I'm supposed to maybe look at doing a morning week there, doing evals or something.
You're like, I could fly
have
up there.
Have you ever tried to find the freaking airport?
I know. It's the size of the table we're sitting around.
It's not even that big. No. True. I'm saying, like, in reality, it's an airport.
Right.
But when you're at 5,000 feet,
it
looks like a freaking thimble.
I know.
Yeah. So, like, I'm flying,
surrounded
you know,
by mountains, yeah.
Yeah, I'm flying around the mountains.
I can't fit.
Though,
I don't think I can do it.
No, I never found it.
Oh, you literally couldn't see it.
I just went back to Reading. No. It's like I'm not good at that stuff,
I'm not either.
I'm not good at this stuff.
I landed in Truckee, but when you're way up in the air,
that's true.
I think of an airport as like, wow, here's this big old thing.
Flashing
lights and, arrows.
Yeah.
And
at nighttime when the stuff's on, you can see it a lot better. But when you're in the mountains and you're looking down at a small airfield, it is not as big as you think.
No, it's totally – that perspective is something – you don't get anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I think anybody that hasn't spent much time in a small plane. It doesn't look the same. It is hard to identify. You can fly right over an area you grew up in.
Right.
And not be able to identify what you're looking at. You know it's the town, right. But you can't really see it from that perspective.
I got to tell you guys one really quick story. When I was getting my VFR, I did my cross-country flight. It involved that guy, the helicopter guys. So it involved those guys. It involved flying over to Sonoma. It starts to rain at like 4,000 feet. I've never been up in an airplane when it's raining. So I'm thinking, crap, what the hell do I do?
Yeah, is this bad?
Yeah. Are there some like windshield wipers? What what do you do? So they have an emergency frequency, right? So I'm like, I said, I hate to bother you guys, but I'm not far from your airport. Number one, I don't see it. Number two, it's like raining. And I go, well, can you see? And I go, well, yeah, it's blowing off the windshield. Well, then you should be okay. I go, well, thank you. And
I don't feel any better.
And then when they stop laughing.
You can tell he's laughing. He goes, are you on your first cross country? And I go, yeah. I'm sorry to bother you, but one other quick thing. I know I'm close to your airport, but I don't see it. And he goes, okay, turn on your – I think my transponder was on. Said, okay, I got you. I remember the number of the plane was
8. He's like, you're right above it.
8146 Alpha. So he goes, yeah, we have a visual on you. He said, look to your left and down. It's right in front of you. So,
see, those are the days it's fun to be an air traffic controller.
So I landed. All that's fine. I take off again. Then I come back. So I got the the Army guys who almost hit me, it starts raining, and then I couldn't find Sonoma. And then when I'm finally coming back to Redding, I'm coming in. I caught a wind shear, and a guy was landing upwind. A guy's coming in the wrong way.
Right.
So I catch a gust. The guy's coming in the wrong way. I did a go-round and pulled out to the right, and then I came back around and landed. And so my instructor, Lee Agnew, God bless her, she's an awesome instructor. I called her when it was all over. I'm sitting there with a big old glass of whiskey and ice going, Lee, oh, my God, you got to hear what happened. You got to hear what happened.
You're not going to believe it.
You're not going to believe this.
This has never happened to anybody ever before.
Yeah, and she goes, she listened to it. I mean, I said the Army helicopter almost hit me. I said, I couldn't find the airport. It started raining. You never told me what to do if it rains. There are no windshield wipers on these planes. Yeah, so, you know, you didn't tell me you could fly in the rain. And then I came back around. I got a wind. I had to go around. A guy's landing upwind. And she said, well, what did you do? And I said, well, I dodged the two other planes and did a go around on that. And I found the airport and landed. She goes, well, very good. You did very well. And she said, you know, Dr. Cormier, I have to tell you, you had more things happen on your first flight than most people have in a lifetime.
Oh, man.
And then she goes, if you tell your, in a real serious voice, if you tell your friends about this, no one is going to want to fly with you.
Oh, yeah, you know what? That's the point.
So you got to keep that to yourself.
Yeah, keep that to yourself.
I haven't told anybody that in a
long time. Nobody will know.
No one will hear it today either. No one will know. All right. We have to have a short celebration of capitalism here. Are we good with that? Good. So you are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, where we have all sorts of information about Dr. Sid. And seriously, it's extensive. When we come back, we're going to talk about his book. You'll never believe what it's called. This is a veritable, just like a candy store for Bob. So the name of the book, before we get distracted and talk about something else. So this is the first book you did, Am I Normal?
Right. No. Life Guide.
No, Life Guide was the first one. Okay, so the one, Life Guide, Keys to Emotional Strength. And that was, 92. And then the Am I, I'm going to post the link to the Am I Normal book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you wound up on Oprah Winfrey and all sorts of stuff. Okay, why'd you write the book?
I wrote Life Guide to try to help people, give like kind of like stuff I'd show people in counseling in a book form, everything I knew to try to help them deal with stresses in life, problems or whatever, past traumas, difficulties, cognitive issues. So I kind of put all the stuff I do in a book, including what I was talking to you about, situational engineering, sphere of influence, the little voice in your head, what you say to yourself. So there are a lot of little books in the book there. But the first chapter was called Am I Normal, which a publicist heard that, called me and said, hey, you have a book here in and of itself. So Carolyn Graf called me and said, we'll offer you a publishing deal for trade paperback and publicize it a lot if you write the book. So I did, and the next thing you know, Life Guide kind of got way overshadowed by Am I Normal? I'm doing all these radio and TV talk shows and around 93 on that one. So,
oh, was that the one that got you on Oprah?
Oprah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because she did a lot. She did book reviews almost every show, right?
Yep. I was right before her kind of, before it really took off. Mm-hmm. And, oh, my God, I'm not bitter. I want you to know I'm not bitter.
Sure.
Because I've had a great
life.
I can tell. Yeah.
But I was in Dr. Bagley, the foot doctor's office. I'd been playing soccer and windsurfing, and I got my toenail crushed.
Oh.
So I'm in his office getting a nail bed removal. So I get a call from Alice McGee from the Oprah show asking for a revisit, you know, get back on and talk about your book and be with a panel on us and all. So I said, I can't right now. I'm in surgery, but, you know, I'll let you know or whatever. This is so, it doesn't piss me off. It doesn't at all, and I'm not angry. But Dr. Phil popped into the panel.
Ah.
First time back yonder, you know, he got involved, and it was
It was all Dr. Phil.
And he sucked all the air.
Past. Yeah,
sucked all the air out of the room while you were dealing with your toe.
I was dealing with my freaking toe and I didn't go back on. It's like I should have just said cut the toe off. You know, put a bandage on it, caught me on the flight, you know. But
Dr. Phil was the next Army helicopter.
He ended up getting involved as a guest due to being selecting witnesses on juries.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
he was consulting for jury selection.
Right.
Oh.
So it's kind of weird. He came from really different places, and I was working with actual.
Well, that's really how he kind of got his own deal going. As a result of.
I didn't know that.
It's kind of, and it's not. Yeah. It's not that I was working with actual real patients, and not jury selection. And I'm not bitter or angry. And I'm not saying I could do a better job.
I'll have that look out for you.
Couldn't find the airport. Darn it. Land the plane.
Oh, God. Okay, all right.
Our dog just had his toenail torn off, so, you know, actually, when you say that, we're both like, because it looks bad.
I had for pain a toe injury. It's one of the worst. I remember I had a glass of white Zen and a Percocet that night.
It seems like there's probably rules about that.
Stephen Lear's Stephen King's The Langoliers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was... Oh, my God.
I'm never flying again.
I'm never doing it. The Langoliers are coming.
Look what's in my brain on Percocet.
I totally remember that. Pinchot, or whatever his name was the guy in the movie. Yeah, and the Langoliers were coming.
And then you figure out later, they say on the little bottle, do not mix with alcohol.
Sure.
Which
is
a bottle.
Read.
You just read the part of how many you're supposed to take. I don't worry about the rest of it.
Isn't it implied? It comes in a bottle and it looks like medication. It's implied you don't drink things. No equipment, no booze.
No, the toe thing is very painful. I remember I smashed my toe when we moved a couple years ago. Oh, we did a yard sale and I dropped a chair or something on my big toe. Smashed it. Oh, my gosh.
It was Don's big chair. That big.
Yeah.
It throbs.
Turned it all
black. Like crazy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was limping around for 2 weeks. Yeah. It took over a year for that toenail to grow back.
So.
Yeah, it was awful.
Okay, so go back on the book thing. Okay, so in the land of books.
It's all over the place today, aren't we?
I know. I told Bill, it's going to be like a car careening out of control.
It's her.
You know, which
it's
is.
Not me.
Which
I
is,
can focus.
It's not me. Oh, sure. No, I was thinking about the book thing. Okay, so once you sit down and write a book, it's kind of like, do you sort of mentally check it off your list of things that you've done? Like, there are people who just, they do it once, and they just write books from there on out.
Yeah, what happened was, it was like, you know, writing nonfiction is what I do, and it's like I had an idea, what can I get across to people? I talked to Dr. Joyner, he was my editor. And I said, yeah, I want to get out to people everything I do. I got some good ideas, you know, I think, and a lot's already been done, but I'm putting it all into one place. So I want to get that out there for people and give examples of it. So I did the proposal, which is a couple of chapters and an outline in competitive books and my bio. And he said, yeah, you know, McGraw-Hill will take it. We'll take it on as a project. So you don't do the whole book.
You don't write the book and then try to get somebody to print it.
You do, not normally. you do a proposal summary, competitive books, your bio, who your primary, secondary, and tertiary market are, and then you and if they like it, they'll usually give you a cash advance, and then you write the rest in whatever time.
Yeah, and then, that makes sense.
Am I Normal was the first chapter life guide, so it was like, so people were saying, "Well, this is." I said, "Yeah, I hear this question a lot. Am I normal? You know, I thought this. Is that normal?" I said, "Yeah, let's just do a psych eval in a book. We'll just do what I do for my evaluations and check each category, like bipolar, schizophrenia, ADHD, depression, you know, panic, all those things." So I have like 10 or 12 chapters. So that book was purely designed to reassure people. Like, if you got this problem, here's what you can do, but here's the boxes you have to check
in order to be broken.
Yeah. To have the disorder, and it's really clear out of DSM-4 and now 5. There's a certain number of criteria you have to have, or you don't meet the standard for it. So it was designed to, you know, to reassure people, and then a lot of people wanted to, you know, get that on talk shows and everything. So
what's the most frequent symptom people come in with and want to know if they're normal? I mean, is it voices?
Not at all. That's really, to be honest with you, schizophrenia is exceptionally rare.
Right, right.
I mean,
what would be the most common?
Most common would probably be depression, and then
The
anxiety disorders. From what I see, I'm seeing people that may be disabled, so a lot of what I see is bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And
what is that anyway?
Bipolar.
We hear it a lot.
Yes,
but what is
fluctuation in mood swings from extremely low to agitated and extremely high. It's a little tricky because bipolar is like a prolonged roller coaster down and high with different variations. You can have rapid cycling up and down. You can have down for years and then up for months in a row.
Oh, wow.
So
I thought it was more, you know, up one day, down the next day,
rapid
up one
cycling
day.
One particular
is,
type.
Is that more
but
common?
But that's rapid cycling compared to more standard bipolar is a little more rare. Mm-hmm. But you can get it hourly. You can get people during the day.
Oh, God, that's
exciting
confusing
for their family.
And what it is it's no real precipitating event. It isn't like you won the lottery or you lost your job or your husband.
Oh, nothing sets it off.
It's endogenous. It's endogenous mood swings for no apparent reason, but it's got to have life-damaging consequences.
So meaning you can't hold down a job. Nobody wants to.
Yeah, I mean, there are people that Churchill, I believe Roosevelt as well, some really famous people have had bipolar.
Really?
And done a lot with it. Yeah, so during the manic phases, the guy that wrote the guy that created the test that I wrote Am I Normal off of, the diagnostic interview, he was bipolar. He climbed Mount Everest, and he said it. I went to his seminar. He said, yeah, I'm definitely bipolar. You can accomplish a lot in a manic phase, and here's all the stuff I've done. So that's a common one, but you got to have life-damaging consequences to it in order for it to be a problem. So if you're perfectly dialed in as, say, bipolar type 2, you know, you have ups and downs, but it doesn't create any big problems in your life, and you produce a lot.
Well, that's probably what was wrong with my ex-wife. She was fine during the day when I wasn't there. When I came home, she went off the bed. So she's probably bipolar.
That's
it wasn't me.
That's a precipitating event.
It's not me. It's her.
Fish oil. No, it's true. Fish oil. Everybody listen carefully. Three times the normal dose of fish or krill. Tremendous mood stabilizer.
Really? Wow.
Scientific fact. Yep.
Wow.
Absolutely.
I had no idea.
Absolutely.
I better stop calling those Prius cars krill then.
Yeah. I don't know. Every time I try to drink, my mother used to make us drink fish oil when we were children. And ever
that was
since
cod liver
then,
oil.
Yeah.
I guess that counts. Cod is a fish.
It's weird because that came out, over 10 years
fish
ago.
Oil?
And yeah, fish fit, but it's got to be 300% of the normal dose. You're three times the amount.
Wow.
So fish oil usually comes in
about
two caps, it would be six.
So what about the mint-flavored fish oil? That was exceptionally tasteful. I really liked that.
Hold on. Let's see if we have a sponsor that might be telling us about that.
And when we come back, I'll tell you what my dad used to say about fish oil.
But there's
a
book called The Omega Miracle that came out, I think it was in
and
the
it was
90s.
Real?
And no, it was just the Omega-3 thing.
Right,
yeah,
right.
It was,
but I mean, it was a miracle. It was a good thing.
Yeah, it was rated as great for your heart and your joints and your overall health. It was tremendous. And then I believe it was in the 90s now that they came out with the studies. They actually took bipolar people, gave them three times the normal amount of omega-3, and they found, whoa, this works as good as Depakote. you know, which is a really powerful mood stabilizer with some big side effects.
Well, and then they just found out,
I think it was 2 or 3 years ago that I read about it in a conference, that krill does the same thing. So
I mean, you could actually
see, I couldn't take krill. It. My cholesterol went through the roof when I started doing fish oil on a regular basis.
We'll have Bill analyzed during the break here.
I need some special
We have 2 minutes
help.
To find out what's wrong
excuses,
with
excuses, Bill.
What's wrong
just
with Bill?
Drink the fish oil.
We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I love fish.
I thought fish oil was supposed to help your cholesterol.
Yeah, not me.
That's good cholesterol.
Not Bill.
You're weird.
I figured out how to rig the test, so I didn't.
Crazy. I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling.
Yes or no question. Do you hear the voices or not?
That's a chapter in life. Little voice inside your head.
Really?
That's a chapter.
Well, there's the nice little voice inside your head that tells you to bring an umbrella and you ignore it and then you realize that you're stupid.
Yeah, I got a question. What about people that talk in their sleep? What's that all about?
Yeah. And is singing a problem?
I don't know, but I had this really cool dream two nights ago I could tell you about. I haven't figured
it out. I sang
Camp
Town Races to Bill one night when I was sleeping.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, talking
through a Western phase,
I'm a little unclear on that one. I don't know. I know people do it, and I know there's some somnambulism.
Oh, my brother would do it. I mean, he'd sleepwalk, talking to sleep. I mean, he was very active when he was asleep. And, of course, we tormented him a lot when he was a child, but he still.
That's a whole different therapy.
Yeah. He could carry on a conversation
a
in his sleep. And then a lot of times you wouldn't know he was asleep until he said something totally obscure, and then it's like, you're asleep, go back to bed, and then go back to bed.
I am, of my domain of knowledge, you happen to stumble upon the one thing I've never learned, so
good
thank
job,
you
Bill.
Very much.
There you go.
I really
Boom.
Appreciate that.
Well, we saw the
nice job
that
of exposing him, Bill.
He's a hack!
It took an hour. They finally broke
took
me down.
He snapped him right before the commercial break.
Oh, boy.
Well, we read that you've been in Mensa. Okay, so I was reading, Bill, some of your stuff, right? So you were in Mensa in 1973. Bill's like, how do you join Mensa? I'm like, oh, if you have to ask. You know? So I thought, okay, Google, I'll do a little search. So I'm like, how do you join Mensa? So it had a little thing. Hey, you could take a quiz online. So I click the thing, and it comes up to a dead page. I'm like, this is the test. The test is, can you get to the actual link? So actually, I found a workaround, and I got to the link, and it didn't say you won or anything. Mm-hmm. It didn't, didn't give me
any. You still had to take the test.
You still had to take the test. You still couldn't get there from here, but we laughed. It's like, all right.
The Mensa people, when I got to Mensa, I was in New York at New School in Manhattan, and it's a real academically powerful place. And with all due respect, I'm sure there are great people in Mensa and everything, but the people I met in it were extremely unusual to be
No. Yeah.
Very polite.
I knew somebody who was Mensa, and they couldn't socially communicate.
One of the things we did that I thought was really kind of cool, I played a game of chess against a guy in our heads.
Oh.
You have to remember every piece, every position.
Yeah,
that's pretty
difficult.
Cool. And you call each other if you don't get it right, if you don't remember everything and what you're doing. So that was...
Okay, that would be hard.
Yeah, that's...
It's very hard.
Yeah.
But if it...
Kind of fun, though.
It is, because you're checking each other and agreeing on what you're doing and then making your moves.
Yeah, you'd have to find somebody in Mensa to do that with you, because I would imagine the normal circle.
Then I realized, to be honest with you, I realized the people that I was talking to have huge brains that are totally being freaking wasted. It's just unbelievable.
They're looking at all this random weird stuff.
Random weird stuff, obsessions about things, tremendous knowledge base in certain areas that I won't get into because they're a little bit weird in and of themselves. But it's like, hey, if you're blessed with a big brain, put it to use making the world a better place, you know?
Right.
Yeah,
so.
Wow. It's like having a sports car, but it's in the garage all the time.
I let my membership lapse and subsequently took a few really hard falls skiing. So I don't know. I'm not sure I'd still pass.
We laughed so hard, though. How do you get into Mensa? Like, Yeah, so you did a whole bunch of stuff, and I'm really curious when we come back, okay? I realize this seems backwards because we're going to do it in the middle of the show, but I'm curious how you got involved in what made you think as a young person, hey, I should become a clinical psychologist.
Oh, that's a good story.
I have a nephew. You remind me a lot of Travis.
Yeah.
Oh.
And
is he still in prison?
He's at San Diego State, and I think he's going to...
That's where my daughter went.
I think he's going to get a degree in psychology, and I'm like, oh my gosh, he's going to be just like you.
Cool.
Kind of made me chuckle, so I need to get a window into his future. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People. Join us on WeThePeopleRadio.us.